Welcome to BIC Magazine's Industry Roundtable, the podcast where business and industry connect. BIC Magazine's Industry Roundtable, brought to you by BIC Media Solutions, the leader in branded marketing and advertainment for the energy and Christian marketplace.
Hello, this is Mark Peters. I'm the host of BIC Magazine's Industry Roundtable. Today, we're going to be giving you the audio portion of a webinar we recently held with IVS Investment Banking, a leading provider of merger and acquisition, recapitalization, management-led buyout, private placement, and consulting services. The name of this is Let's Make a Deal. It will cover a variety of topics and lessons learned in M&A. In moderating the discussion is IVS President Thomas Brinscoe.
For those of you who are not familiar with me, I also own BIC Alliance, publisher of BIC Magazine. And my father-in-law, Earl, and I had started IVS Investment Banking some years ago. I'm very proud to have some very talented colleagues on the panel today with me. I'm going to start with the managing director of our investment banking company, IVS, John Zapalak. John has been with IVS since 2007, but he's got a nice 25-year run in the industry, has a couple of finance degrees from Texas A&M, whoop, and spent some time in New York City doing different types of transactions. I met John when he was on the opposite side of the table from me in a transaction, and we became friends and eventually business partners. Say hello, John.
Good morning, everybody. This is John Zapalak. How's everybody doing?
Also with me today is a colleague, Bert Vigay. Now, Bert is also an attorney, but he practices where I do not. I like to joke that I might be smart enough to read an agreement and have a question. I'm smart enough to ask a question, maybe, but this is the guy that really puts the documents together and gets a lot of the deals done. He's got 30 years in the industry. He is the a partner in the corporate practice group of Porter Hedges, which is a Houston-based law firm, and Bert is a veteran of hundreds, if not maybe a thousand or more transactions. Say hello to everybody, Mr. Bert.
Good morning, everyone. This is Bert Vigay, and thank you for that introduction, Thomas. I think you ask a lot of very good questions, so that's what this business is about, is asking the right questions.
Mm-hmm. And joining us on the line is another colleague that I've done some business with, the managing director of a private equity group, Hastings Equity Partners, Mr. Tanner Moran. Tanner is actually the managing director over there. And for those of you who are not familiar with Hastings, they have recently invested in several privately held energy services companies, and he's on, in addition to his work at Hastings Equity, he is on the Energy Advisory Board at the University of Houston, and he also serves on the board of directors for the AGC Houston chapter, which, for those of you not familiar with it, is the American Growth Capital, essentially a professional association related to mergers and acquisitions. Tanner, say good morning, my sir, so everybody will know which voice is which.
Good morning, everybody. It's great to be here with you today, and I look forward to visiting with you further throughout our discussion. Thanks, Thomas.
We're going to cover generally preparing for a sale. For those of you who might be listening and are considering the sell side of the transaction, and we want to talk about the deal team that maybe you need to put together to be most successful in reaching a successful conclusion. Everyone always wants to talk about valuation and really what's my company worth or what is the company I'm buying worth. We'll talk about deal structures and sales processes. We'll talk about identifying buyers for a business. And on the flip side, reasons you might want to be a buyer. And with that, we'll start off the program by discussing preparing for a sale. Now, it's a huge financial, strategic, and emotional decision to sell a company. From a technical standpoint, Bert, what do you think the most important actions are about preparing to sell a business?
Well, obviously, and this This goes, this needs to be noted that when you're selling a business, you, first of all, you've got to build a nice business to sell. I mean, that's what your day-to-day work is about, is building a solid business, building a business that attracts buyers, and having something with repeatable cash flow that a buyer would want to acquire and that fits with the business that they're doing. So you can evaluate the preparation in terms of 90 days in advance of the sale, or a year in advance of the sale, or long-term planning, you know, 4 or 5 years in advance of the sale. I guess we should maybe start with the further in advance analysis. And I would say that the important things are to have your business in a business entity that will allow you to sort of harvest the value when the sale time comes, and to avoid paying large amounts of your success to the federal government in terms of income taxes. So a lot of people organize their business in business entities that are flow-through entities, or sometimes they're in C corporations and they're taxed as a separate entity, or subchapter S corporations. And there are subtle consequences to doing that, depending on the form of the transaction and the structure of the transaction when the sale comes out later. We'll cover some of that, I think, downstream, but that's probably one of the key issues to think about.
Yeah, proper business format is going to be a huge implicator in really how much we cash out for. I think your point, Bert, of really having an attractive company is going to be one of the key ingredients there. John, did you have anything to add?
Let me kind of jump in on, Bert kind of talked a little on the legal side. This is John Zaplak. When we look at it or would advise somebody, it's kind of on the financial side to where what Bert said, kind of say, let's just stay a year out. There's a couple of things that an individual can need to do as far as preparing for the valuation. Well, first and foremost, In the time period you want to sell or recapitalize your company, you want the profits and revenue and free cash flow to be about at their highest level. So you want your business to perform the best at or around the time period we're selling. Items that you'd probably want to do is get with an accounting firm. It's probably worth maybe getting reviewed financials for a year or two, because what you don't want is a surprise in there with the revenues. A lot of small businesses will kind of do cash-based accounting for tax purposes. Some revenues will be in the wrong periods of time, and it'd be good to get those revenues that are maybe in January of the following year pulled back to December, so the accounting is kind of on what we call a GAAP basis. The more we can get that to look right, the less surprises there'll be. The other item is you can start – you don't have to completely change everything you're doing in the way of, hey, I'm running my expenses, a high-level expense to keep my federal income tax at the lowest level. An item you can do is to track those, what we call add-backs. We'll get into those later, but the more you can track, the more you can document these, what we call one-time non-recurring expenses or excess compensation expenses to owners, the more you can do that, the better off we'll be in trying at the time we're getting ready to review this to be able to figure out this valuation and the highest valuation for a seller.
Yeah, I guess I could just kind of recap maybe a year out. A business owner might bring in an accountant and do an accounting review on their systems and reporting systems, and to ensure that they're properly done and the reporting is regular and reliable. That you consider the control procedure, your controls and procedures, and get your material contracts properly documented. When you get up to a sale date and due diligence begins, you might find that a lot of your materials are not really in order for sale, and it makes the process less smooth, makes the diligence less smooth. Then approaching maybe 90 days out, you might do a corporate review, which involves bringing your minutes, your board minutes, and your stock ledger and everything up to date, so that too is in order for a due diligence review.
Yeah, I think all those are excellent point. I mean, I think, you know, first and foremost, when you think about a sale, I mean, from a time frame, it's at least a 12 to 18 month preparation process. So, you know, like you mentioned, John, you want your business to be in a good, steady position. You want to have had a couple of good years behind you and also have some good runway for growth in front of you in order to maximize the value of your business. In terms of the preparation, I think Bert's comment about bringing in an outside accounting group to either do an audit or at least at a minimum a quality of earnings report, I think that's absolutely critical. One of the first things any buyer is going to do when they look at your business is to come in and pressure test the financials. And having an independent third-party view that's not your own that is prepared at the initial discussion point always helps just give a baseline threshold credibility to those numbers that may not otherwise be there. I think in addition to the financial side, you know, preparing the documentation, thinking about, you know, getting a data room together to have a contract, et cetera, is critical. But also, I think from a philosophical standpoint, you know, what is it you that the owner wants to do? What is the reason that you're selling? What is the upside for your business? Because those are all things, if someone is coming in to acquire your business, that's because they believe that there is potential for them to have a return on their investment in addition to the return that you generated on your own. And so having a clear pathway, a mindset for strategy of that all is very important. And then ultimately, just really, what do you think that your business is worth? What is it? You know, go out, have a test from the market, bring in a group like John's and Thomas's to come in and kind of tell you where things are. I think all of that will get you in a good position to have a realistic expectation of how a process is going to go and how things may shake out.
Yeah, thank you, Tanner. Last note on this topic, for a special note for small business owners, one of the key things that I have seen lacking when people approach me about potentially finding them a buyer for their company is that the company is too owner-centric. And oftentimes, you know, a smaller company that might be in the 10 to 40 million revenue range, a service business, the owner of the company that may have founded it and brought it to its current level, while he recognizes the need to bring on some partners to take it another level up, he hasn't set himself up with plenty of reliable management. And if that we'll get a ding from a potential buyer.
I think that's a great point. To do some succession planning in the year or so before a potential sale, to identify and train a potential CEO, especially in a case where you have a financial buyer. It may be where a strategic sale or a sale to a strategic buyer occurs. The strategic buyer has personnel on, you know, in the business that know how to operate the business, but and for financial buyers, it's very important to have a sound management team, and that will affect your pricing.
I know we're going to move on here, but one last thing on where they're going with succession planning, and that is, you know, I think as an individual owner, you need to think through exactly what do you want to do? What is your timing? What do you want out of that? And then when you engage, basically on our next slide, an M&A advisor, that's kind of where you're able to reveal what you're trying to accomplish. And the whole really idea of doing this transaction is to accomplish the business owner or shareholder's goals.
Mm-hmm. Moving on, then we'll talk about the deal team that potentially you want to put together. We'll move quickly through this slide, but the idea is, yes, you are going to need an M&A advisor. I've seen so many companies leave a lot of money on the table by not engaging an advisor. Matter of fact, John and I had one case study in particular where we had been pursuing a client for a number of years, and we found out through the grapevine that he had a contract to sell his business or was entertaining it, and convinced him at the last moment to allow us to represent him. And I know that we put $10 million additional cash dollars into his pocket.
Well, you want me to jump in? Basically, what an M&A advisor does, M&A advisor, investment banker, it kind of does two things. One is it's able to put together your historical information, your financials, and so forth to get an idea of where the valuation is going to be. But kind of using Thomas's test case here, when an M&A advisor like ourselves, we go out to the marketplace, we'll take, under a confidentiality agreement, we'll take the business under in a confidential information memorandum, we'll take it out to 200, 250 type of buyers, qualified buyers. Many of them are like Tanner. Most of them are like Tanner. Private equity group sitting on a couple of $100 million. So the point of all that is you could go out to your neighbor or to one group and get an offer, but what we're trying to do is take it out to 200, 250 groups to basically make the market and get the best price, best deal, best terms to rise to the top.
We'll talk about more about the deal process later. Certainly having a good M&A counselor, attorney at law, is going to be important on your team, and it's probably not the family attorney that's represented you in collections cases over the last few years. I think that specific experience is hyper important. The accountant and tax advisor, certainly nothing but tax implications and this whole thing, and other trusted advisors or something to bring on board.
Yeah.
Bert, did you have something?
No, I was just going to say, I think all of us sitting around this table have seen a lot of situations where a general civil practice attorney who's a trusted advisor and sort of consigliere to the family maybe has been hired to do a transaction, and they just don't work in the space or don't do M&A work, and it's been a tortured and difficult transaction. It's helpful to have someone have a lawyer who does M&A work, merger and acquisition work, as their regular practice. Also, it helps to have a firm where you have specialists that can support the needs of or issues that may come up in labor and employment area or ERISA and employee benefit plans. Those are very technical, tax-driven, statutory requirements that need to be addressed. You may have environmental issues. You might have real estate issues. And you might have some litigation. And so, that you need a trial lawyer there. So a lot of times what people do is they hire an M&A lawyer to sort of act as a quarterback for the team of lawyers, whatever lawyers are needed, and access those specialists, to the extent they're needed to do the transaction. But I also wanted to say something. You mentioned the accountants and tax advisors. I believe that my suggestion would be for the deal team that those are the people you want in the very front end.
Yes.
Because the structure is so important.
Bert, just one thing. You kind of all over it. If they don't hire the right M&A attorney, why don't you speak to real quick? I mean, basically, if you have just your general counsel, civil attorney, they don't know the marketplace of what these deal terms are, like what goes into escrow, how long. I mean, that kind of just touch on that, because you'll spend a lot of money educating your attorney, figuring all this out.
I think that's right. I mean, the structure of a typical transaction, whether it's a stock purchase transaction where they're buying the entity, or it's an asset purchase transaction, a lot of buyers would prefer to buy assets. They're acquired under a definitive purchase agreement that's maybe 50 or 60 pages long, or maybe in a smaller transaction it's 25 pages long, but it's substantially comprised of representations and warranties by the seller, who's receiving cash or a good deal of cash in the transaction, about the condition of the company and its assets and its sales and its relationships with vendors and its relationships with employees and so forth. And a lot of that, of what's in that give and take in the document, it's helpful to have somebody with market knowledge. And your M&A advisors know quite a bit about it, but it's specifically in the representations and warranties and the contract and the indemnities, it's very helpful to have a knowledgeable, experience.
What's right and what's wrong, what's doing.
Yeah, and in recent years, they've gone to rep and warranty insurance. So there's a lot of buyers like Tanner's firm probably would prefer to, when they are selling, when you're harvesting your investments,
that's become a very, very popular theme. I mean, I think just in summary of all the things you guys are saying is valid. I mean, it's the hesitancy on the seller side is to engage a high quality firm in any of these representations, but the reality is it's well worth the cost to bring in a blue chip, large, multifaceted firm, whether it's on the accounting side, go for a big four, because that's what's credibility is going to be viewed upon from a lender standpoint, from a private equity group standpoint. Go with a top tier law firm, not your local attorney, as you folks mentioned, because they're just, there's a credibility standpoint, there's a bandwidth standpoint, and there's an awareness of market terms that will ultimately get you the best deal. And that, quite frankly, we encourage a lot of times on the other side of the table, they're not using the firms with the sophistication information that we would use when we sell our business. And we encourage owners, because ultimately, if you're using your local attorney, your family attorney, it's going to ultimately slow things down and make for a more complicated with a higher risk of failure. And you ultimately won't save the money that you'll save in the end is not ultimately worth it, because you will have had ultimately a worse outcome, not getting the best deal for yourself.
Thank you, Tanner. Moving on to the next slide here. Let's talk about business valuations and what's your business really worth. Now, in the industrial service and manufacturing space, typically businesses are valued on a multiple of EBITDA, which is an accounting term that most of you may be familiar with, earnings before income tax, depreciation, and amortization. Would anybody like to take a quick spin on more of a layman's definition of EBITDA here for our listeners?
Well, I think you've pretty well hit it. Mm-hmm. I mean, basically, EBITDA is just a proxy for your cash flow. I think, though, you need to step back just a second to think through what is a buyer, or what is your company really worth? Your company is really worth the future revenues and profits, or what really is free cash flow in the future, kind of discounted back to present. EBITDA has become a very, very popular way to basically calculate this. It's a proxy for cash flow. And so you use this, what Thomas has described as earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, amortization, and you multiply times kind of a market multiple. And that's what's become very, very popular in the way that businesses, what we call the enterprise value of the business, which is the value of the business prior to any debt financing, is calculated. And so, you know, we drivers of that multiple are going to be, you know, kind of what is your industry? How fast is your individual company growing? The faster your company's growing, the higher that multiple goes up, the higher your valuation. The more recurringness of your cash flow, Tanner and I just had a big discussion about this in a client meeting a couple weeks ago. The more recurring it is, the higher the multiple gets. And thus, the flip side happens in all this too. So the less recurring it is, the more customer concentration and so forth.
So, John, for instance, yeah, so if I've got a company that has 15-year leases on all the equipment that I'm leasing, what you're saying is if I've got, making $1 million a year on 15-year contracts, a buyer may look at that and say, I'm willing to pay you something close to $15 million EBITDA. Whereas if it's a project-by-project basis and I've got to re-earn that business every year, maybe a buyer is going to pay less multiples.
I think what Thomas is describing in the lease is that guaranteed recurring revenue coming in. And yeah, his points were very well taken. I mean, let me give a little different. Coca-Cola, it's it's in every country. It's in a little can, and it gets sold every day and all that. There's not much that's really going to stop Coca-Cola from selling every day. It's kind of a guaranteed revenue stream. Its multiple of EBITDA is 12, 15 times. Thomas's point is, if you're doing project by project and you don't exactly know or don't have a guaranteed revenue stream, because you don't know that those projects 8 months out are going to happen, it will cause a discount. And so, you know, we don't really want to get into multiples, but, I mean, people are wondering. So I would just say, in our kind of downstream services sector, we kind of see a multiple of EBITDA for a good, solid, growing company. Revenues 20 to 50 million in sales, which we see a lot of that, in kind of that 5 to 7 times multiple area. And Tanner will probably come in and want to say
it's really multiple. Yeah, that is, I don't know about I'm not going to speak to that specifically, but I think just at its core, I mean, this whole concept of a multiple is the present value of the future cash flows of the business. So the more stable, more recurring business that you have, the higher multiple that you can expect. I think on top of that, there's many key drivers, such as, you know, the scale of your overall business. A company that's in the single digits of EBITDA versus the double digits of EBITDA is going to receive a discount to the larger overall business. If you're to look at, you know, sort of your basket of public companies, you know, they're going to be trading certainly at a premium because of their scale, diversification, pricing power, customer diversity, et cetera. And so you really need to kind of benchmark yourself and your business based upon a number of those factors. And so a popular way to do that in order to prepare yourself for the sort of what is my business really worth discussion is to look at a set of comps or comparable transactions, which is typically typically put together by folks, you know, like John and Thomas or any investment bank that tracks the, you know, last, you know, 2-3 years worth of transactions that share based upon, you know, earning size, et cetera. It kind of just gives you a feel for how other businesses traded in the market. And really then you can kind of match your business up to that. But, you know, other things to think about that have a material impact on that valuation is the capital intensity nature of the business. So if you're to think about this concept of sort of cash flow, I mean, if your earnings are high, but you have to invest several million dollars a year in order to grow your business, your free cash flow is ultimately lower. And so a lot of buyers look at it as an EBITDA less CapEx type profile. And on top of that, some buyers who are strategics, they're really looking at you from an asset standpoint. And so they're going to think about you not just from a multiple of earnings standpoint, but they're really going to look at you more of a book value standpoint. Because the question is that classic decision, if they're in the business and they're a competitor to you, how much of a premium over the replacement value, the incremental value of the assets that they have in the business are they willing to pay versus go and simply buy one more spread of equipment, one more, you know, hire one more team. And so, again, book value, a multiple of book value is another popular comparison, especially when a strategic buyer is ultimately involved.
Yeah, let me kind of jump in on something Tanner said. You know, at the end of the day, though, the market will make the multiple or the price of the business. And that's, again, when we take it out to a couple of hundred groups, you know, if the market is going to come back and you hope to get 3, 4, 5, 7, 10, as many offers as possible and pick the best one from it. But at the end of the day, we can have comps and all that. But the current timing, the current situation, the marketplace interest, all that interest rates, all that plays a role into what is the market going to respond to. And the market will give you a price. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, whether we like it or not can be a different discussion. But so that's how the price is set for the business. One thing I just kind of as a side note, that we're talking about the what we call the enterprise value, the price of the business. The net amount received by our clients is what we're going to now call the equity. And basically in these transactions, the business is worth X, or just as a simple number, $10 million. If much like a mortgage, if you've got $3 million of debt, of long-term debt, line of credit, debt on your equipment, that's going to be the responsibility of the seller to pay off. So much like a mortgage, if your house is worth $10 million, your business is worth $10 million, and you owe $3 on it, your net proceeds received is going to be $7 million. So we want to keep that clear. There is a value for the business determined by a multiple of EBITDA, or as Tanner alluded to, the discounted free cash flows. But the seller, we have to subtract off the debt, and then what's left is the net equity. Now, we would add cash in there, but most companies don't have tremendous amounts of cash, and I don't really want to confuse the situation. Debt's usually the bigger driver in all this. And so at the end of the day, when you calculate the equity, it's much like you can read in the newspaper. If your equity's worth $7 million and you got 1 million shares outstanding, like a publicly traded company, you divide it by 1 million shares, you get a price of $7 a share. And so what's happening in the stock market, what happens in our market at the end of the day is kind of one and the same. We calculate it the same way. We just don't watch a fluctuation in the price as much.
So there's a lot of rules of thumb out there. And to borrow John's analogy of a mortgage, if I'm in a neighborhood and I've got a certain rule of thumb that the houses are selling for X dollars per square foot, some houses still sell faster than other houses, even though the rule of thumb is the same. You know, what do buyers really look for besides EBITDA? What's going to make a company super attractive? I know one thing that I've seen a lot that, you know, a certain broad customer base where you don't have a client concentration in a particular area, strong procedures and processes and documented in place for a company oftentimes would be like that renovated kitchen that you walk into that kind of takes your breath away. What other items out there, Tanner or Bert, you know, do you have some ideas about what makes a company attractive besides that?
Sure, I think it, you know, starts at the macro level. So what is the end market that this company is ultimately, you know, creating its product for, offering its service in? You know, what are the growth dynamics from that? Is it a positive outlook? Is it a relatively stagnant outlook? Or is there, you know, technology risk or political risk, whatever it may be, that ultimately is going to contract at that market that they're serving in? So, you know, looking at the the macro level, thinking about, you know, just the growth potential of the business, you know, what's the ultimate scalability, what's the strength of the management team, and what is the, what makes the company different? You know, what is it that they do that others cannot do? And so what's ultimately going to command and drive this business's opportunity to get to that proverbial next level? Are they a better service-oriented business because they have a better process? Do they have a unique widget? And then what is their path to market, and what's it ultimately going to take to get greater buy-in in that so the company ultimately grows? So for us, it's really, is the business operating in a growing market, and is does the company service of a unique enough quality with a strong enough management team that it can take advantage and become a major player within the market that it's operating in?
Thanks. Yeah, I think you know, other considerations include for smaller middle market companies, things like whether or not the how well capitalized the company is, whether they have vulnerability to customers for particular markets, and whether whether they have vulnerability to distributors. I mean, sometimes participants in a manufacturing and distribution chain or service providers are bound or somehow tied to a particular line of products, and those suppliers can determine the profitability and the future opportunities of the business. Scalability is something Tanner mentioned, and I think that's huge as well. Is it a protected niche, but it's a very small niche, and it's hard to grow outside of that niche, or are there opportunities to scale up and to go nationwide or worldwide?
Is it market share versus a growing market? That's a critical.
Thanks, guys. Let's look at some of the typical deal structures on M&A transactions now. A lot of folks, you know, in the lower market, lower middle market that I've dealt with over my career, a lot of folks initially are thinking of sale in a very traditional sense, where the owner of a company is ready to retire and perhaps he doesn't have a succession plan in place, no children in the business looking to take it over, and, you know, cut our teeth on helping folks with those types of transactions. But in dealing with private equity groups, certainly we're looking at more of a leverage recapitalization. For those not familiar with that type of transaction, an owner does not typically...
Let me interject. Even if it's not a leverage recapitalization structure, what is the importance of the owner continuing participation in the business from the point of view of a financial buyer or a private equity buyer? I mean, would you say that's...
It's probably ultimate high, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any?
Yeah. Case? I mean, in the, you know, businesses that we're primarily dealing with, these are, you know, entrepreneur-led, founder-owned businesses. And so this was the individual that was the best at what they did, you know, that was a, you know, mid-level employee in a large company that ultimately said, I can go out and do this on my own. I have the respect of my customer base. I have a dedicated team that can come in and do that. And they ultimately put the business together. And in a lot of our transactions, I mean, they are absolutely critical to the business. So, you know, really, we are not comfortable with 100% purchase and outright mm-hmm. sale.
The buyer, you insisted.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And we do that, you know, not only to have management continuity because of the, you know, people-centric nature of these businesses, but, you know, also because they will, for any individual, it is their company, right? They started it. It's their name on the door. It's their people, their personnel, their relationships. If you don't have that continuity going forward, then you put your investment at serious risk, and it's going to be that much more difficult to execute on your ultimate return. So really knowing, even if a complete sale of the equity occurs, having every owner at a minimum needs to be ready to have a transition period for themselves.
Exactly.
It's going to be a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think to a point that was made earlier is then having, if you, it is important that you have that full outright sale, which is more difficult than not to execute on. Who are those individuals behind you in your organization that you have been bringing up mm-hmm. over time that are ready to step into your position? Because essentially buying a business without a leader that continue to drive the business going forward, that's going to make the transaction more difficult to get done. That's going to have a significant impact on the ultimate value that you can create. So it's I think that's, you know, that's the first step, is really understanding what is that owner's role in the business and what's that owner's role going to be going forward, and then you structure around mm-hmm. that.
So as the seller, you have to be prepared to stay with the business for some period, 2 to 5 years, typically, the rule of thumb, but it could be different whether or not you maintain some equity in the business going forward. The leverage recapitalization, though, is different from a 100% outright sale because typically the owner is going to maintain, keep some skin in the game. And typically it's a minority interest in the company.
I'll take a shot at describing both of these over the phone. So we're going to talk numbers, and we're not going to have a board to put it up on, but hopefully everybody can follow that. Basically, you kind of got two options, and option two being so many private equity groups like Tanner has been the leverage recapitalization. That seems to be, I'd say, 75-80% of our transactions are heading. But I'm just going to kind of verbally describe the two options with numbers. So if everybody can follow this, we've talked EBITDA. Let's assume we got a company with $10 million of EBITDA. We put a 5 multiple on it. That means the enterprise value is $50 million. Minus no debt, the equity is worth $50. In option, $50 million. In option one, the 100% outright sale, theoretically you would hope you could get $50 million in cash from a strategic large group. Probably for these service companies, that's not the way it's going to go. It would be $35, $40 million in cash and a $10, $15 million note. Tanner shaking his head. He's agreeing with me on this. So in option one, a strategic sale, you get a chunk of cash and a note, maybe 7%, no real upside on it. Well, we like to show the clients the leverage recapitalization, which is option two. Using the same numbers, if the equity is worth $50 million, maybe our client takes out $35 million in cash and keeps $15 million in stock. For simple math, to finance the $35 million on $10 million of EBITDA, we borrow $20 million.
Yes.
That would leave $15 million to plug in there. So Tanner's group would write a $15 million check. Our client kept $15 million. It's basically a 50-50 partnership. They're going to need control of 51%. But in this particular leverage recapitalization, you're able to take out $35 million in cash, own 49% of the company in this example, have a heavy-hitting partner like a Hastings group to grow this company from $10 million of EBITDA to $20 or $25 million. And basically get upside as opposed to the in option one, you just kind of got a fixed note at 8%. So there's no personal guarantees on the debt that we talked about, the $20 million that we borrowed. So effectively, you're able to kind of work with a little more of the house's money, work 3 to 5 years, have upside in an exit strategy and a very well-groomed partner in a group like Hastings or whoever the private equity group is. And so that's kind of the differentials between the two. One, the leverage recapitalization, you get upside in the outright sale. You probably have limited upside, but a responsibility to work.
You know, I should probably interject on with regard to the leverage recap. I've seen a number of incidents where owners have sold the business and sold down to 30 or 25% or some yeah. number like that. The private capital group has added additional capital and personnel and made available opportunities that really didn't exist with the limited capital that the prior, you know, that the original owner and founder had. And it's given the original owner and founder an opportunity to take chips off the table, and they're overinvested in the one stock. It's very successful. Their private business.
Their company is very successful,
but you know, this gets them retirement money and but leaves them with a significant stake in the company. It leaves the private capital company with a sophisticated founder as a partner, sort of a parallel investor with them, with a financial stake in the business, and then allows them to grow the business to a higher level, and they'll have a second sale event. And sometimes there have been two or three of those events, and in the second and third event, they actually make more money than the first one. You think maybe you're selling most of your stock in the first one, but as a value transaction, the second and third transaction are better for the owner than the first one.
Real quick, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but Tanner, why don't you talk about growing the company through acquisitions and what the initial investor who took the rollover stocks, they don't have to guarantee any of that debt. And what's your path to grow a lot of these a lot of times?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, our approach is to, you know, take two paths. One is the, you know, organic-based growth. So, you know, working with your existing customer base, bringing in, you know, new customers, growing your in-house sales force, et cetera, pushing more product, more service through your existing channels. I think the second opportunity is to be acquisitive. And, you know, what we've found over time is that since we can be incremental bandwidth to the management teams that are running the company on a day-to-day basis, we bring a knowledge base and experience set to go out and acquire either like businesses in different geographies but similar service lines, or from a strategic standpoint, say if we are, you know, providing a, you know, welding services, you know, specifically, but it would make sense to have inspection services or cleaning services or I&E, whatever it may be, as a complement to your existing platform, to go out and effectively acquire an entity that is the sector expert at doing that. So our view is that a business that is specialized but is good at a couple of things is going to create a value premium to a business that is specialized and able to really only do one thing. So it's a popular practice of private equity to go out and acquire complementary service lines. And it will accelerate the growth of the overall business. It may also have value benefits that you are getting arbitrage on an investment. So an add-on acquisition is, albeit typically smaller, either of similar size or smaller than the platform company, what your initial investment was. And together, they are a bigger, larger, more diversified business. So you may get an arbitrage between what you're acquiring that add-on at and what your overall platform is worth once that transaction is complete. So it's it creates a lot of value to go out and make those strategic acquisitions.
Now, I've been involved in some transactions where the platform company eventually went public, and their EBITDA multiple was in the 6 or 7 range, and they were acquiring small, undercapitalized private companies in the 4 or 5 range, and that's the arbitrage play that you can. Their cost of capital is much lower, and so it puts them in a position to, if they're smart about their acquisitions, to position themselves for acquisition after acquisition.
Sure. I think one other thing that's important to point out is that, you know, if as an investor comes on board, you've taken material chips off the table, you own a meaningful portion of that equity going forward. A lot of, you know, sellers will say, you know, well, what happens, you know, if the private equity firm is to invest more dollars? I mean, I'm going to get diluted down. That's going to, you know, decrease that ownership percentage they ultimately have. Well, two things typically happen. First is you have what's called a preemptive right. So you have, for your pro rata ownership percentage of the business, you are typically allowed to invest pari passu with the private equity firm to protect, preserve your equity ownership percentage. Part two, if for whatever reason you decide ultimately that you don't want to do that, an add-on acquisition is still accretive to the value of your equity. So albeit you may own a smaller percentage, it's actually creating a greater value for that ultimate smaller percentage. So I think what's really important and owners should appreciate is that if an investor is going to come in and do on an add-on acquisition, and in any leverage recapitalization, you have excellent alignment between buyer and seller, because you as a material equity holder of the business have the same interest of creating value on that equity as the private equity firm, the majority owner, may, as their job is to go out, invest, and generate a return on capital for their investors. That's what they're getting paid to do. So in that leverage recapitalization model, there's really excellent alignment between the two parties that are at the table, and there's a significant amount of legal protections that occur that any additional acquisitions that are made or investment capital that's put in from the equity side, that it will be value accretive, or it should be value accretive to the sellers at the end of the day.
But Tanner, at the end of the day, if a shareholder has taken out this money, put it in the bank, and you come in as a private equity group and want to make additional acquisitions and you need additional capital, and yes, they are protected through the legal documents to have the right to basically invest pari passu, they don't have the obligation to have do that.
If they choose to
keep their cash, it's just an investment decision.
Right, absolutely. It's an opportunity for them.
Yeah.
But they get the benefit regardless.
Yeah. I definitely want to sincerely thank our panelists, Tanner, Bert, and John, for participating today. And thank you, everyone, who has logged on to listen live, and to those of you in the future who will be listening on demand. God bless and have a great day.
Thank you for listening. We would like to urge you to look for future presentations on IVS Investment Banking, and also to make sure you read the IVS Mergers and Acquisitions Marketplace articles that appear every month in BIC Magazine.
Thank you for listening to BIC Magazine's Industry Roundtable. Log on to BICMagazine.com for industry news and updates. Industry Roundtable is brought to you by BIC Media Solutions, the leader in branded marketing and advertainment for the energy and Christian marketplace.
BIC Media Solutions, the leader in branded marketing, edutainment, and advertainment for the business, industrial, and faith-related marketplace, helping industry partners produce meaningful media in the form of books, films, TV, videos, promotional events, and speaking opportunities. Our goal is to help you creatively communicate your message, not only to a specific audience, but to the masses. Let BIC Media Solutions tell your story. Call 1-800-460-4242.